Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website where I keep all the archives, 4,000-something interviews going back to 2003. Sign up for the podcast feed there as well, ScottHorton.org. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right, introducing the heroic, the great, the wonderful, the best, Gareth Porter, my favorite reporter. And he's got one today at Truth Out. We're running it at antiwar.com as well. It's best news I've heard in a long, long time. Turkey and Iran reach agreement on conditions for Syria peace. Tell me everything.
Well, Scott, this is indeed good news. I don't want to overstate it in the sense that, you know, this is being presented as the end is in sight in Syria by any means. But it is a starting point that is extremely important. I feel very confident in saying that this is a stronger start toward an eventual peace agreement to end the war in Syria than anything that has happened under the auspices of the United States, Russia, and the United Nations. In other words, that series of UN-sponsored big international meetings where all the parties are invited, except in one case, Iran was not invited. In another case, none of the Syrians were invited. But in this case, I think what we have is the parties that are in a position to make decisions that could bring about a cessation of support for the Nusra Front al-Qaeda folks on one hand, and pressure on the Assad regime to bring about certain political reforms that could at least satisfy Turkey that there is a political system in the making in Syria that, you know, is fair to Sunnis as well as other religious groups. And that would be the basis then for a ceasefire and a political settlement. So that's the vision that underlies the beginning sort of preliminary agreement on principles that Turkey and Iran reached this week, or which was announced at least on Tuesday by the Turkish Prime Minister and confirmed by the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran.
Mm-hmm. So now you bring up here you call it a major policy shift by Erdogan toward getting along with Russia and Iran again now?
Right. I mean, the reason that this is happening, as far as I'm concerned, is clearly that President Erdogan of Turkey made a major foreign policy decision to pull back on the reliance on the simply relying on the combination of military pressure by the al-Qaeda folks, Ahrar al-Sham, and their allies against the Assad regime, translating into decisions by the Russians, the Americans, and ultimately Assad to give in and in some fashion give signals that Assad was ready to step down, and then instead of that to rely on a deal with the Iranians and by implication at least with the Russians to essentially bring about a deal such as the one that I just outlined in one sentence, and of course I need to rephrase it and repeat it, a deal that would involve on the side of Turkey clearly ending the the support for the armed opposition to Assad across its border on the side of Iran and Russia, putting pressure on the Assad regime to agree to certain political reforms that is thus far resisted. But in addition to that, the part of it that I haven't talked about yet, and which is the reason for the Turkish shift in policy, is that it would involve a commitment to reining in the Kurdish forces in northern Syria, forcing them to, or at least putting pressure on them sufficient to get them to agree to retreat beyond or east of the Euphrates River, something that at this point they show no sign of being willing to do. And of course, the United States could be helpful in that, could be involved in that, but the agreement that has been reached just the last few days clearly does not require that the United States be willing to do it. It would mean that the Russians and the Assad regime together would put pressure on the Kurds to pull back.
And that's to pull back the what's now the western border of independent Syrian Kurdistan to move back further to the east. Is that correct?
That's part of it. I mean, that's a partial description. But what's involved here is the Turkish fear that what the Kurds are now planning, and indeed they're undoubtedly correct, that the Kurds are in the process of knitting together, pulling together two parts of a Kurdish or two separate zones of Kurdish control and knit them together into a single Syrian Kurdistan, if you will, a mini state that the Kurds would at least claim is an autonomous zone which has the potential for an independent state. And that, of course, is what the Turkish government has declared in the past and still now is insisting cannot happen. They're insisting that that's a red line, and that in addition to that, the red line in terms of Kurdish military forces is that they must move back to the eastern side of the Euphrates River. Now, you know, how that's exactly going to work, that remains to be seen. But that is indeed the Turkish demand at this point. And the United States has, so according to the Turks, the United States has promised that it would get the Kurds to pull back to the east of the Euphrates. But so far, the United States has not done that and indeed has not been publicly talking about it. And I cannot say precisely what the U.S. position is on that. But so far, there's no sign that the U.S. is acting on that that red line of Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're certainly... Well, I don't know, certainly, but it seems like we're helping the Kurds extend their eastern border further. I saw some reports of sectarian cleansing in that town that they had recently liberated from the Islamic State. So I don't know how determined they are to bite off more than they can chew there.
According to the information that's now available, the Kurds have already made it clear that they want to capture Al-Bab, which is the town or small city near the Turkish border that would mark the furthest they've moved their forces from the east to the west, and that is what supposedly is one of the factors that has motivated Turkey to take this pretty dramatic diplomatic move toward Iran and Russia in response to what they perceive as the intention of the Kurds to move further west and to, as I say, basically prepare the groundwork for a single major Kurdish mini-state along the Turkish border.
All right, but now... So I guess I'm a little confused about this because it seems like they've had an autonomous mini state in Syrian Kurdistan for a while, but you're saying it's basically divided in two major parts and that It's if the Turks can...
parts, the, I mean, the larger part of it is indeed the part that you are, and I think most people are well aware of, which covers the eastern side of that territory that the Kurds control.
And you're saying right now the Turks will grin and bear that, but what they can't bear is the combination of the two different Kurdish regions being joined.
Well,
into one.
At least that is the implication of their current action. Now, yeah, you know, they would not say that they're ready to accept it by any means. No.
Well, it really raises the question of what they're going to do about independent Syrian Kurdistan. I mean, they have a decent relationship with Barzani and Talabani in Iraqi Kurdistan, but the YPG are, you know, basically the cousins of the PKK and the eternal enemies of Erdogan's government. So
right, and the further implications, of course, of the consolidation of the full territory that the Kurds now control or could control in the near future is that they would in fact constitute when combined with the Kurdish territories in Turkey and in Iran, they would constitute the farthest reach of Kurdish territory thus far in contemporary history. So there is a real threat here to, you know, the Turkish and indeed Iranian and Syrian concern about Kurds forming the Kurds potentially forming a single Kurdish state, which crosses those or extends into the territories of those three states.
Yeah, boy, it's going to be interesting in it the aftermath of the sacking of Mosul by the Shia militias and the Peshmerga and the U.S. Marine Corps here coming up in a couple of months.
Right. And of course, I haven't mentioned that, of course, there's a Kurdistan in Iraq as well that is also part of that picture. And all of that fits into the picture here of Turkey.
The next war. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it certainly is a major cause of all sides here acting in ways that constitute a serious conflict, potential conflict that could turn into a war.
Yeah. All right, now, but so it is a real big deal, though, back to the beginning here about Erdogan has basically decided he is willing to back down from insisting that Assad must go.
Well, that is one of the implications of the principles that have been adopted. Now, you know, it's a bit more complicated than that. The two principles that have been agreed on are, first of all, that, of course, the one we've been talking about is that that Syria must be not partitioned. So, in other words, the Kurds would have a recognized mini state that would be allocated. And of course, the concern is the United States is moving towards that policy. I think that's clearly the implication of this. The second principle is that Syria will have a government, a political system that is fair to all religious and ethnic groups. And this represents, of course, the Turkish concern that Sunnis have been shortchanged in the political system of Syria, and their insistence that has to change. Now, you know, that's what I think. We know that the Russians have been trying in the past to push Assad to accept very significant constitutional reform. They have drafted a constitution which they submitted to the Assad government late last year, if I remember correctly. It was reported last spring by Al-Akhbar, the pro-Hezbollah daily in Beirut. And according to Al-Akhbar, the Assad regime refused all of the changes that the Russians had proposed. So that didn't work. But it did indicate that the Russians are pretty serious about trying to get Assad to accept very far-reaching changes. But, of course, they have not used all of their leverage that they could potentially use. And that clearly is implied that the Iranians would rely on the Russians in trying to reach this agreement and carry out the agreement. So those are the two principles. But there's a third principle that was discussed by the two sides and not agreed to, and that involves the way in which this agreement would be reached. The Iranians clearly were not yet ready to put very strong pressure on the on Assad to step down. And what the third principle is that the future of Syria would be decided by the Syrian people themselves. Now that's code language for the question of whether Assad would have to step down before a settlement is reached. And by agreeing to that potential principle, or by having that principle on the table, the Turks would be recognizing that there is an alternative acceptable to them, that an alternative to Assad stepping down before the final settlement is reached. And the question is whether the details of the other two principles would be fully acceptable to Turkey. And that appears to be the question mark that still remains. If those details are acceptable, then it appears that the Turks would be prepared to accept the third principle. So that's the fine detail, the wrinkle that underlies a third principle that's not agreed to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the two sides.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. I wonder if they worked it out, if the Americans would still keep back in Ahrar al-Sham and Jabhat al-Nusra anyway.
Well, that's a very important question. Not clear at this point how the Americans would respond to, or how they are responding. What is their response to this very important diplomatic shift by Turkey? And I think they're undoubtedly at this moment in a series of sort of emergency meetings trying to figure out what they're going to do about it. Are they going to hold out, resist this, put strong pressure on Turkey to change their policy? Or is it, on the other hand, contrarily, going to change the politics of U.S. policy toward Syria in the other direction? Sort of changing the balance, if you will, between what I perceive at least as the differences between the White House on one hand and the major bureaucratic interests, the DOD and CIA, supported to some extent, but resisted to some extent by the State Department, which is that they want, of course, the United States to continue support for the Al-Qaeda and their allies in Syria, because their primary interest is to continue the pressure on Syria and to lay the groundwork for a long-term U.S. military presence and CIA covert operation in Syria. So I think that remains to be seen how this is going to work out in terms of U.S. policy.
Yeah, it's completely crazy. And part of me, and not only have I been doing this a long time, I've been talking to you about the finer details of it for a long time, but I still kind of can't get over the fact that anybody in D.C. with a straight face can pretend that Iran, Assad, Hezbollah are the problem here, when Al-Qaeda are the ones who knocked our towers down, and the Islamic State are the ones who cut our reporters' heads off. And, you know, to read, Daniel McAdams has a great one today about Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post just screaming her head off that Iran and Hezbollah are fighting in Syria. Iran-backed militias are fighting in Iraq, but she never says who they're fighting against. They're fighting against our only enemies. But we're just supposed to just forget that and just put Israel first, I guess. If Benjamin Netanyahu and Michael Oren and the rest of his policy advisors say that the Shia Crescent axis of evil is the real enemy here, then, who cares about who died in the towers? That's right, a long time ago now.
That has been at least the rhetorical basis for U.S. policy in Syria now during the Obama administration, particularly since 2013, when they began to see the 2013-2014, let's put it somewhere in that period, when the Obama administration first realized that the that Al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, Al-Nusra Front, and its jihadist and Salafist allies really had the potential here to put strong pressure on Assad and could be the basis for, you know, a policy of really putting pressure on to force Assad to make a major concession of stepping down as part of an agreement. And that became the rhetorical the thrust of U.S. Foreign policy in Syria. So, I mean, that indeed, I mean, what you've described as the neoconservative Israeli position has been accepted by the Obama administration, covering up the reality that the only legitimate security interest the United States has in Syria is to stop Al-Qaeda from taking over and Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State from taking over. So, I mean, that is indeed the major cover-up that's been going on and continues and has to be resisted strongly, be opposed strongly.
Now, I don't want to be, you know, too kooky about this, but I think it's a fair question. You know, Patrick Coburn said on this show from 2011, certainly 12 on, that, hey, American and allied, you know, NATO and GCC and Turkish and whatever. Oh, yeah, that counts as NATO. NATO and GCC support for the jihad in Syria is re-energizing the insurgency in Iraq. And if you go to Baghdad, any Shiite politician will tell you, holy crap, this is so dangerous. What are you doing? Please stop it. And we know that in the August 2012 DIA memo, they describe this as a real danger. That's the quote, is that there's a real danger that if we create an Islamic State in eastern Syria, that it could blow right back into Iraq, too. And I wonder whether you think that there were people in the White House and the National Security Council who took basically the same thing you just said. It was, you think they're thinking about Syria, and applied that to Maliki as well. Oh, so you don't need us. You only need the Iranians, huh? Well, let's see how you like having a re-energized Al-Qaeda-based Sunni insurgency. And I bet you need America again now.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing that that's the case. The reason being that Obama had staked so much of his reputation on the idea that the United States, his reputation in terms of his policy in Iraq specifically.
Well, I don't want to be too narrow about Obama either. I mean, I have that great clip that you found of Jim Mikuláczewski back in 2009 when Obama was taking power saying, yeah, over here at the Pentagon, they say we're staying in Iraq for 50 years and they don't really care what the president thinks. They stole it fair and square and they're keeping it. Hell or high water.
Right. So, okay, I was really limiting my answer to the White House, the National Security Council, and Obama.
And that may have been how I phrased it in the first place.
Yeah.
Sorry, but.
So to the broader question, absolutely. I think that there are undoubtedly individual officials who, you know, from the beginning of, you know, sort of seeing, the jihadist presence there becoming very effective, were beginning to think, well, you know, we could use that in our policy to put pressure on Assad. So, yeah, I have no doubt that it was viewed that way by individuals from the beginning. And it's you know, you've got a very complex set of interests here from 2012, 2013 down to the present, and with various shifts going on. For example, when the war against ISIS began. And the Pentagon had its own war in Syria. That was a shift that affected the internal bureaucratic politics within the Obama administration on Syria policy. You know, I think it would have made those people who were involved in carrying out the war against ISIS, even more adamant about, you know, no war against the Assad regime, would have strengthened their determination, of course. I mean, that's just an example of the kind of complications in the bureaucratic politics of Syria policy in the Obama administration.
Yeah. And so now, well, let me ask you this. I read this great article the other day at War on the Rocks that was debunking a lot of the mythology about Sunni this and Shia that. And I think maybe he was being, you know, a little too generous about the Badr Brigade, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, I guess to kind of paraphrase it, the guy is saying that, yeah, there was a lot of ethnic cleansing or sectarian cleansing by the Shiite militias back in the bad old days of Iraq War II and the Civil War there. But more or less, once they won Baghdad, they didn't want to continue expanding the borders of Shiistan. And so when they've kicked the Islamic State out of Samarra, out of Tikrit, out of Ramadi, out of Fallujah, they are not expanding the borders of Shiistan. They're letting the Sunni populations come home, and they're even, incorporating Sunni militias in with the Shiite militias to help fight alongside the Iraqi army against the Islamic State, Sunni tribal leader militias and that kind of thing. I wonder if you think that, I mean, to me, this sounds very hopeful, basically, if I can try to take it at face value, Gareth, that, you know, because the worst danger is that whatever is done against the Islamic State, sort of like as we've been talking about with Kurdistan, whatever happens against the Islamic State, we're going to have a brand new normal that's going to be very abnormal, and we're going to have a lot of incentive for people to push to make things back the way they were again, maybe, yeah, you know, the days before the Islamic State, right, if not fight to save the Islamic
absolutely.
State.
Absolutely. I think it's more complicated than you know, sort of saying that the Shia, you know, have changed their attitude, changed their ways completely, you know, in the current conflict with Islamic State in Iraq. I mean, you know, certainly they have learned some lessons, and I think they have been chastened by, you know, the failure of certain things and the cost that in terms of Sunni resistance and support for Islamic State. But on the other hand, there are certain ways in which, you know, if you're determined to use traditional military methods against the Islamic State, even with, you know, efforts to leaven it with, you know, political methods, you are going to have certain choices that are tough choices. And we know, I think it's a documented fact that the Shia militias, and the government to some extent have been, forbidding some Sunni from returning to their homes or from remaining in their homes in areas where they're trying to establish firm control. Just this morning, I was, seeing there was a story, from Iraq that the, actual families that support or are members of, not support, but are members of the Islamic State are not being allowed to return to certain places where the government and the militias are reestablishing control. Now that's to be expected. That's not surprising. But, you know, there's a danger, obviously, in that turning into, a limited form of cleansing that makes, you know, that pisses off the entire, Sunni population of the area. So, it's not easy to draw the line here. Is all I'm saying. It's very easy to fall into policies that can be provocative.
You know, of course, there's going to be abuses and this kind of thing. The real question that we'll just have to wait around to see is whether they really try to expand the border of Iraqi Shiistan to, for example, include Fallujah from now on and really make that a super majority Shiite city, that kind of thing. I guess we haven't really seen any effort to do that yet, right?
Not that I know of, no. I don't think that's...
And the policy of the Dawah and the Supreme Islamic Council always was strong federalism, meaning have George Bush kill all the Sunnis and give us the capital city,
But other than that, they never really were hell-bent on trying to dominate Mosul, Ramadi. Well, I guess Ramadi, kind of, but Mosul, Fallujah were sort of outside of the protection of Baghdad in 2014, is why they were so easy for the Islamic State to sack in the first place.
Yeah, in the majority Sunni cities, they're clearly not going to try to change that. It's in places that are near the cities, smaller towns, where they're trying to establish security zones. I think that's that's an issue, definitely. That's a question mark.
Yeah. All right. Well, and just further consequences on down the line then. And here we keep going, Gareth.
Yep.
All right. Listen, you're the best. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Scott. Good to talk to you always.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. He won the Gellhorn Prize for his journalism about Petraeus and McChrystal killing people based on their cell phone data back in the Afghan surge. Really great stuff there. He's the author of the book on the Iranian nuclear program, Manufactured Crisis, the Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. He writes mostly for Middle East Eye and truthout.org. This one is republished at antiwar.com today. Turkey and Iran reach agreement on conditions for Syria peace. That's the show. The website's at scotthorton.org. Check out the archives. Sign up for the podcast feed there. Help support at scotthorton.org/donate. $50 or more, you get the brand new Rothbard book of long lost essays from the late 60s. And follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show.